Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
She's the least qualified in terms of judicial experience in 38 years. Now, some would argue that maybe we need to have people who don't have judicial experience. I saw a survey indicating about 70% of the American people think that judicial experience is a good idea for somebody who's going to be on the Supreme Court.
That's Senator Mitch McConnell commenting on President Obama's pick for the U.S. Supreme Court and her lack of judicial experience. But not so fast, say Democrats. Here's Press Secretary Robert Gibbs firing back.
There have been notable selections that didn't rise directly from judgeships, the last being William Rehnquist, who was ultimately elevated to Chief Justice.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer, and if she's confirmed, Elena Kagan will become the fourth woman to serve on the nation's highest court, and she's already been confirmed once before as President Obama's Solicitor General. But all the experts agree that a life seat on the U.S. Supreme Court will be much more hard-fought and hard-won, and so the battle lines are already drawn, and perhaps the biggest issue to arise thus far is that of experience, specifically Elena Kagan's experience as a judge, or lack thereof, because Kagan has served not one day on the bench. Here to discuss the significance of that fact is Jeff Rosen. He is a law professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. And his latest book is The Supreme Court, The Personalities and Rivalries That Defined America. Jeff, welcome and good morning.
Good to be here.
Well, I think it's fair to say, Jeff, that even before before the president's announcement on this nominee, the handicapping began. She had been on the short list before the Sotomayor nomination. And the critique is coming from both the right and the left. There's the military recruitment issue at Harvard. There are the various positions she's taken as an attorney over the years, including the now somewhat famous exchange with Chief Justice Roberts over the First Amendment rights of corporations in the Citizens United case that she argued, and I guess we should say lost, as the president's Solicitor General. But she's going to have an opportunity to address all of those at the confirmation hearings. The overriding issue that is coming up that she cannot perhaps explain away is that of experience, or perhaps lack of experience. And that's why we have you here, Jeff, because that question is informed, if not by the nominee, by history. So before we get to the issue of the long history on this issue, let's talk about Elena Kagan. If she's confirmed, how will she compare to her brethren, if we can even use that term? She'd be one of three women on a 9-person court. How will she compare to Chief Justice Roberts and the other justices in terms of judicial experience?
It is true that she will be the first non-former appellate judge on the Roberts Court. All of the other ones previously served on the federal bench. By contrast, none of the judges who decided the Brown versus Board of Education case in 1954, striking down school segregation, were former judges. So Kagan supporters say, thank goodness, this is a great thing that she's not in the judicial monastery, to use the cliche. And the argument goes on to say, well, we had two nominees in 1971, William Rehnquist, who later became Chief Justice, and Lewis Powell, the former head of the Richmond School Board, who had never been judges before. It's only a recent norm that you have to have served on a lower appellate court. And I guess the argument would further say many of the people on the Roberts Court were hardly long-standing federal judges. John Roberts himself had only been on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit for a couple of years before he was elevated to Chief Justice. So in the end, I think just as experience proved not to be argument with a lot of legs during the Obama presidential campaign, because people understand that Supreme Court justice, like president, is not a job that you can prepare for in any sense. It's a talking point right now, but I can't imagine it will be at the centerpiece of the hearings. And in the end, of course, her lack of a paper trail will probably help her rather than hurt her, which is one reason that Obama may have chosen her.
You write in your most recent piece for The New Republic that you've known Elena Kagan for many years, going back to your days as a clerk for Abner Mikva. He's a feeder judge to U.S. Supreme Court clerkships, and of course she did go on to clerk for Justice Marshall. Is it fair to say that she's a student of the U.S. Supreme Court, of the institution? What's her resume, despite this lacking in one critical area?
Well, as you say, she rose through these meritocratic institutions at every stage, excelling in them. She went to Princeton. She went on to Oxford on a fellowship, went back to Harvard Law School, where she developed a reputation for reaching out to liberals as well as conservatives, clerked for Judge Mikva and then for Thurgood Marshall, who called her shorty. And then she was an academic. You see the pictures of Obama sort of towering over her when he appointed her. But she was a law professor for a long time. I first met her when she just started teaching at the University of Chicago Law School, and her academic specialty was administrative law, which sounds kind of technical, but is going to be at the centerpiece a lot of the debates about the constitutionality of health care and of economic regulation that the Roberts Court is soon going to be fighting. She then went on to the Clinton White House, started in the White House counsel's office as a lawyer. Clinton was said to use her as a kind of walking encyclopedia. Whenever he had a legal question, he'd call her judge, and he'd call her in and kind of quiz her with things. And then she did so well there that she went on to be deputy chief of domestic policy. And there she was in charge of tobacco reform, reached out to Republicans, and convinced John McCain and others to support giving the Food and Drug Administration authority to regulate tobacco. And then went back to Harvard and became dean of Harvard Law School. And probably that's her most salient political or institutional experience. I mean, the truth is lots of people go through these clerkships and high government positions, but to actually run an institution that big with so much money, she raised, you know, tens of millions of dollars, is got to affect your view of institutions and of politics and of dealing with people. And it'll be interesting to examine what the impact of that was on her views about business cases, which are going to be at the center of these hearings.
And certainly examine them we will. My name is Jamie Floyd. I'm in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Jeff Rosen, professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., legal affairs editor of The New Republic. We're talking about Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan and her lack of judicial experience and whether it should matter in her upcoming confirmation hearings. We'd like to hear from you, especially if you're a judge or a retired judge, or if you have any experience with the court process, of course, with the Supreme Court as an advocate, if you've appeared there, or if you're a law teacher, maybe you teach constitutional law and have an opinion on this. Call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or, of course, you can post a comment at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, Jeff, let's talk about the course of history. There have been many non-judges appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. You named some of the most famous, of course, Earl Warren, well-known and very effective, whatever you think politically of the Warren Court, very effective in the course of our history. But if you go back even to the founders, John Jay, for example, not a judge, someone with judicial experience and was appointed to the court. This is a rather recent notion, isn't it? And I wonder why it's coming up now.
It is a relatively recent notion. I'd seen one statistic that a third of all judges who serve on the Supreme Court throughout history have not been judges. It used to be common to appoint politicians or people who really distinguished themselves in public life. And you're right about Earl Warren. Similarly, on the Warren Court, you had people like Hugo Black, the former Alabama senator who became a great civil libertarian, William O. Douglas, the former head of the Security and Exchange Commission. Why did that norm disappear? Maybe as our confirmation politics became more and more polarized, it was viewed as tougher to get a politician through the Senate. The Senate used to confirm any former senator who was appointed out of deference. There's no deference nowadays. And if you have people with these very similar meritocratic resumes, it becomes harder to attack them for not being qualified, obviously. And maybe that's really narrowed the range of people we're choosing from. Lots of people have noted how odd it is to have a court composed only of Harvard and Yale law school graduates. And it is troubling in a certain way. I went to these schools, too, but they do breed a sort of lack of humility, a kind of sense of entitlement. I mean, if you're concerned about judges who really will listen to different points of view and recognize the complexity of disagreement in a democracy, maybe it's not a great thing that we've narrowed our search so much.
Which leads to the obvious question, and that is, why is Elena Kagan not a judge? And there's a very specific answer. I was in Washington back in the 90s, and I seem to recall, Jeff, that her name was put in the hat for an appellate court slot, wasn't it?
Absolutely right. And, of course, the Republicans wouldn't give her a hearing over a long period of time. And the slot that she was nominated for eventually went to none other than John Roberts. And, of course, he had to wait for a long time, too. So it's almost like sitting on the D.C. Circuit is a ticket you have to punch waiting for the Supreme Court. Both parties know this, which is why they're reluctant to actually confirm anyone. And in that sense, whether or not you have a year or two on that court really doesn't seem so salient. It's more just kind of another hoop you got to jump through.
Yeah, rather ironic that now certain Republicans would be citing lack of experience as a critique when, in fact, she could have been sitting there for the last 15 years. Let's take a call from David in West Orange, New Jersey. David, you're on WMYC.
Hi. I've been practicing for over 50 years. I've been an advocate in the courts up and down the state, up to the Supreme Court. And the question that I have, it's really rhetorical, what do they think lawyers do who are actively practicing in court? They write briefs. And for the most part, the judges that are deciding the cases are using those briefs for their decision. I am sure that every sparkling opinion that has come down from any judge, whether it's a trial judge or an appellate judge, is based in part or in whole on some great idea that a lawyer had. So saying that she hasn't had experience on a court, she's had experience on the pitching end of the court, not on the receiving. And her collegiality probably speaks better for her than most appointments. The second point is, I think if you check back, a lot of judges have been appointed who were senators or who were active politically, which gave them no training other than manipulating the voters when they went on the court. So, for senators to point the finger and say that she doesn't have experience as a judge, I think that's a strength. But she certainly has an experience as an advocate.
Excellent point, David. And isn't that true, Jeff? That much of what we see in the opinions of the court, the Supreme Court, indeed, and all of the appellate courts, comes right out of the briefs and the arguments that the lawyers make.
No question about it. Sometimes word for word. I mean, in cases like the gun-free school zones case, Justice Clarence Thomas took an entire law review article from Richard Epstein at the University of Chicago. So that's absolutely right. And David's broader point that we should be more concerned about collegiality and interpersonal political skills than judicial experience seems right, too. President Obama said very explicitly that he really wants someone who can appeal to Justice Anthony Kennedy and bring the court over to the left, or at least to the center. And he's counting on Kagan, who at every stage of her career at Harvard Law School as dean, at the Clinton White House, has just had a knack to reaching out to people. She even said that when she was nominated. She said, "I helped bring people together on this famously divided Harvard faculty." But it is a real question. Will she be able to do it? I mean, to a large degree, this turns on the psychology of Kennedy himself, and he's a pretty tough nut to crack. I mean, he knows what he thinks, and he has a very aggressive view of the court striking down things like health care and economic regulation. The hopeful scenario is she will be able to win him over in a couple cases. The not-so-hopeful scenario is she'll try, and no matter how charming and collegial and effective she is, he's not going to budge too much. Then what does she do? Maybe she'll become more of a kind of aggressive liberal leader than some of her liberal critics now fear, and I wouldn't be surprised if she actually does inherit the mantle of John Paul Stevens in that way.
Let's turn the argument a little bit on its head, though, because we do have quite a few posts on our chat page along these lines. Can you, Jeff, highlight any sort of skill set that she might be missing simply because she hasn't sat on that side of the bench? Surely there is something you have to take on that's unique to being a judge.
Well, she certainly doesn't have the kind of close attention to the factual details of a case that Justice Sotomayor would, not because Justice Sotomayor was an appellate judge, but because she was a trial judge. And things like knowing hearsay rules and rules of evidence, all the kind of things that law professors like me who don't teach that don't know very well because we've never been in courtrooms, she certainly won't have that. And in that sense, she won't sympathize with the litigation details. But I think the real concern that people have, especially progressive senators have, is that she doesn't have a sympathy for economic populism. I mean, there's a big concern that the Roberts Court is very pro-corporate, pro-big business, because of its decisions tend to favor the positions championed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is not just a Republican thing. Many of the Democratic justices are quite sympathetic to this pro-business sensibility as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that lots of progressive senators, led by Senator Leahy, who's had a series of hearings on this over the past couple of years, are really going to question Elena Kagan closely. Why? What does she feel about business? Is the court too pro-business? And in that sense, even if she'd led the Security and Exchange Commission, like Douglas, or had experiences like Elizabeth Warren, who's now the Obama kind of economic populist in chief, that's a perspective of ideological diversity that's just missing on this court on both sides of the aisle, and Elena Kagan does not have that.
Well, this gets, Jeff, into the substantive critique of the nominee that we're hearing on both sides of the aisle, but I think perhaps the White House is a bit surprised by the disappointment on the left with this nominee. Many progressives feeling that she's not progressive enough. Where is the Marshall? Where is the Brennan? Why is it that the right can sustain a nominee like Alito or John Roberts and manage to get that nominee confirmed and with, say, 22 votes, and we can barely get Sotomayor on the court with 9? And I wonder what your response is to that. I know it's more of a political question than a question about court history, but I wonder what your thought is. It goes more to the substance of the nominee than this question of experience, but since you raise that sensibility issue, I wonder what your thoughts are.
It's an extremely interesting question. You're absolutely right about that. Senator Tom Harkin, the Iowa Democrat, articulated this very explicitly right before Kagan was nominated. He said, why do the conservatives always get the conservatives, but we don't get liberals on the Supreme Court? Now, I think it is a substantive question, and it has to do with Obama's own judicial philosophy. There was an extremely revealing comment that Obama made to reporters at the end of April, where he challenged liberal orthodoxy by suggesting that liberal activist judges in the 60s and 70s had been guilty of overreaching with the judicial approach that he said ignored the will of Congress, ignored democratic processes, and tried to impose judicial solutions on problems instead of letting the process work itself through politically. So then Obama said today it was conservatives who were guilty of the exact same activism, trying to use the courts to reverse their political defeats in areas from health care to economic reform. And this is consistent with a view that Obama took as a constitutional law professor in his chapter on the audacity of Pope. He said that progressive political change has always come from the grassroots level, from political activism, not primarily on the courts. It's a mistake to rely on the courts to be activists because you're likely to be disappointed when your judges aren't in control. And basically his vision, which Kagan clearly shares, is the old tradition of liberal judicial restraint, which goes back to Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes. Basically, the best thing courts can do is get out of the way, uphold progressive economic legislation, argue against kind of sweeping visions of economic justice that the Republicans have. So I very much understand that their progressives are disappointed. But in the end, I think Obama's confident liberals don't need William Brennan or Thurgood Marshall today. Now that they are winning their fight politically and passing all this great progressive legislation, the best thing they can do is fight against the conservative activists on the court today who are trying to strike that down.
We do have one post here who says that Kagan has never had an opportunity to wear one of those fancy robes, and Supreme Court justices, especially the women, are known for their creative decorating of their robes, and she lacks experience on that front. We're just about out of time, Jeff, but I'm going to ask you to make the prediction. You can decline if you want, but do you care to say which way you think it'll go, or whether you at least think her lack of judicial experience will be the deciding factor?
I think everyone on both sides expects her to be confirmed because she'll probably get at least as many votes as Sotomayor did. But the real question is she going to have one of those frilly things on her robe? And there I predict confidently she won't. She refused to wear a morning coat as Solicitor General, so maybe she'll actually have a much plainer robe, too, which would be a great break
good,
in tradition.
Good, because I don't like the doily.
No, it's not a good look.
Well, you heard it here, folks, first. And my guest has been Jeff Rosen of George Washington University and the New Republic. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was a great conversation.
All right. Coming up next, our monthly guest, comedian, writer, and opinion editor, Baratunde Thurston. No, I believe I've got that wrong. No, up next. No, that's later in the program. Up next, we're actually going to take a turn to Albany, and we're going to take a look at what's been happening. Governor Patterson's office has been stormed, as well as a conversation with Liz Benjamin about all things political on the state front. Stay with us.